clerk will call the docket.
Dennis Kern against Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Henry W. McLaughlin, for the appellant. Terry C. Frank, Benjamin A. Wills, for the appellate.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Henry McLaughlin. I represent the appellant. This case involves a question of whether a statute of limitations and foreclosure based on a failure to send to comply with a precondition to foreclosure occurs at the time of the foreclosure or on an earlier date. The circuit court held, and the appellees contend, that this case is barred by the statute of limitations because there was an acceleration decision by the lender more than 5 days, 5 years before the suit was brought.
Did that acceleration amount to a breach of contract?
It is a breach of contract, but there's no damage. I submit to no damages from it.
So the breach of contract occurred at the time of the acceleration notice in 2010. Is that right?
Well, the reason I submit, your question, of course, gets right to it. The reason I submit the statute doesn't begin to run then is because the borrower cannot file suit at that point because he's not been damaged. And so that is it is failure to comply with the deed of trust to decide to send a notice of acceleration. You send a notice of foreclosure, that is, of acceleration under the statute. But I submit it doesn't actually create an acceleration because it wasn't done correctly and can't be enforced, and in fact the borrower isn't in any way damaged by it until the foreclosure. And that is really the crux of the case. Is could you file suit before the foreclosure? And there is one case that is directly on point on this, and of course it's just persuasive. It's a federal court decision construing Virginia law. That's the Jackson case. And in the Jackson case, Judge Locke held flatly that in that case, the suit was brought before a foreclosure. There was no foreclosure. There had been an acceleration. And the Jackson sued for damages, and the court held that it couldn't sue because it didn't have any damages, because there had not been, in fact, a foreclosure.
So is that principle universally true for contract breaches generally, or is it just unique to the to your situation?
Well, if in any contract case, I would submit that if there are no damages, there can be no lawsuit filed. And so the question in this case, I submit, is whether or not there are damages from an acceleration where there's not been a foreclosure. And the one case that seems to be directly on point is the Jackson case, and it held that you could not go forward because the borrower had not been damaged. And there's a contrary case in the Western District, in the Herbal case, but in that case, both the foreclosure and the acceleration had occurred more than 5 years. And so it was essentially addictive rather than. I think I should have said it again. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes. So sorry to ask for that so late. There are, of course, statute of limitations are strictly enforced, but to claim that a statute of limitations starts when a party has not been damaged and therefore the case would be dismissed because it hadn't been damaged has a danger, a real serious public policy danger to it. And the reason I submit is because if in mortgages, in circumstances where people fall behind, a lender can send a notice saying we are accelerating this note, and then decide not to foreclose the borrower, if I'm correct in saying the borrower can't sue them, then lenders would have an incentive to check that box, get that out of the way, and then a lender, a borrower, would no longer have a right to a proper cure notice, which is an important right in the deed of trust. If the loan goes on past 5 years beyond that point, the borrower has no reason to file suit, wouldn't be able to file suit, and then when faced with a foreclosure, when there's never been a proper cure notice, would have lost the case because the statute of limitations would have run. And there's another case before this court in which had to do with the face-to-face meeting and issue. And in that case, the circuit court held that when the borrower first fell behind 3 months, that the lender had to have opted for face-to-face meeting. And since that didn't happen, the borrower would have had to have sued back then, and therefore the borrower lost the right to a face-to-face meeting. And so, in a significant way, this is not simply a procedural matter. It has to do with, does the borrower in this case, and this is true in other contract cases as well, actually have the right? If you have a right that you can't sue on, then how can you lose that right under the statute of limitations? And if you do lose it under the statute of limitations, excuse me, I'm repeating myself, then it's a significant erosion of the right itself.
Why couldn't a suit be brought before the foreclosure, an injunction suit to preclude the foreclosure, or a specific performance suit to demand that 30 days as opposed to 29 and a half days in the acceleration notice was complied with?
I don't believe specific performance applies to a case like this. Specific performance is a case when you file a suit to require somebody to do something. A borrower has no right to require a lender to send a cure notice because the lender doesn't have to send the cure notice. That's discretionary with the lender. So therefore, I mean, if you have a contract to buy a home and somebody won't sell it to you, you can enforce it through specific performance, but I submit you can't.
Could you not have filed an injunction suit the day before the foreclosure saying there are certain breaches that have occurred in this lending transaction and they preclude this anticipated foreclosure tomorrow? Why wouldn't, if that was a legitimate argument, you could prove cause and fact, which is a whole other subject we can't get into at the moment, but if you could prove cause and fact and cure would have been successful, I'd be surprised if circuit court judges wouldn't routinely grant those injunctions, or at least put off the foreclosure until the case could be heard.
The borrower could file a suit seeking an injunction.
All right, well then there's your accrual.
That is the decision in the Matthews case. But that is not a case for damages. And that is not a case, I submit, for breach of contract. It's a case to prevent a breach of contract. But I cannot disagree that, because the Matthews case is very clear on this. It says in a footnote that if the lender has not granted the face-to-face meeting, the borrower can prevent a
right.
foreclosure.
It's the legal remedy, or in this case, the equitable remedy for the alleged breach in the cure notice and acceleration notice.
Well, what I submit in response to that is that a suit to stop it, someone from breaching a contract where it seems imminent. If somebody says, I'm going to evict you, or I'm going to foreclose on you, it is not the same as a suit for damages when you have damages that have accrued from a breach of contract.
So the statute of limitations depends on whether you're seeking an equitable remedy or a legal remedy. Is that the principle of law?
My point is that in a injunction case, you're not suing, saying that someone's breached the contract. You're saying to the court, please do not allow this opposing party to breach this contract by foreclosing on my house. And in a case like that, there wouldn't have been any damages. Now, I do say that, in response to your question, that you can sue for an injunction if someone has not sent the notice and they have given an indication they're prepared to foreclose, but they haven't yet caused you damage, and you are suing to prevent damage. So,
could you seek a declaratory judgment if there's a dispute over the meaning of the contract and how the bank proceeded?
Well, one can file a declaratory judgment action where there's no breach of contract to say, and in fact, what one is saying, I submit in a declaratory judgment action, is we don't know what the rights are between the parties. They are in dispute. And so, therefore, ask the court to decide that. But that doesn't require that there be a breach of contract. It's right. That the parties are viewed the circumstances contrary to each other. That's a justiciable controversy.
Is that right? You don't have to allege a breach of contract. You can just go to court in a deck action and say, I don't know what the answer is. They don't know what the answer is. Please tell us what the answer is.
Yes, sir. I maybe didn't say that right. I think in a declaratory judgment, you say, this party takes this position, this party takes this position, and they are at odds with each other. That's a justiciable controversy to be decided. Each side may think they do know and asserting that it's definitely one way or the other. And I would just end before.
Before you end, what about the Van Dam versus Gay, I think was the other party. What about that case that your opposing counsel cites for this
would
principle on damages?
Remind me what that case is.
Well, it says some injury or damage, however slight, is essential.
Yes. That case says something. But I'm submitting that the Jackson case stands for the principle that in a case that happened there, which is exactly the same as here, there is no damage. And this gets to an important point, which is a claim of acceleration, I submit, is not the same as an acceleration itself. That a party has not been damaged by an acceleration just because someone says that it has been, because they haven't actually done that person any harm, because they don't in fact owe the full amount. It hasn't actually been.
Before you leave the podium, let me ask you one more question, because I'm going to ask it in a minute of your opposing counsel. 8.01.230 says that the accrual of the right of action for purposes of statute of limitations in breach of contract cases is when the breach of contract occurs. And there's at least a half a dozen cases interpreting that quite literally.
Well, I would construe that to mean that the breach of contract is not complete until there is some damage. Because until there is, you can't sue to get any damages.
You have 2 minutes and 22 seconds
left.
Yes,
I'd like to reserve.
And I have to make the observation, if I can, that Mr. McLaughlin, you have finally figured out how to work that clock. If you want 2 minutes, ask for four, and you might get two.
Morning. But please, the court, Terry Frank for Wells Fargo. I think I'll just go right to the heart of some of the questions that have been asked. First of all, the Jackson case, it doesn't stand for what the appellant says it does. In fact, the court in that case permitted the plaintiff to go forward on the acceleration notice. And said because they were asked to pay a large sum of money, they said they were only, that the borrower in that case thought that they were current. The acceleration notice required that they pay the sum of like $17,000. So the court permitted them to go forward on the breach of the acceleration notice. There was a carve out that said to the extent that you are pursuing damages based on a foreclosure that didn't happen, we're not going to let that go forward. But the Jackson case did permit. Denied the bank's motion to dismiss on the acceleration notice. We stand by our position. The Herbach case is directly on point, and it's in the context of a foreclosure and an acceleration notice. The limitation period commences at the date of the breach, which necessarily has to occur before the date of the foreclosure sale. All of the standard language in the deeds of trust that we're discussing in these cases have the lender must accelerate the debt at least 30 days prior to a foreclosure sale. And that's what triggers the breach. The appellant has taken the position that the acceleration can't be the breach because it was ineffective with sort of circular reasoning. Like, there wasn't a breach there because it didn't really accelerate the debt properly. But that's the basis of their breach of contract action. They're saying that it was a 29-day notice instead of a 30. And acceleration, the Harbaugh case and the Jackson case touched on it, acceleration is the touchstone for the right of action, the act at which invokes the note holder's right to foreclose. And so the acceleration has to be what triggers the breach.
Does acceleration mean you have to pay off the balance?
Acceleration says we find you in default, you have 30 days to basically cure the default. And if not, we're going to
accelerate. Okay, so catch up on the late payments and then any penalties, whatever.
Catch up on, you have to get current, and if you have another payment due within that 30 days, you have to make that payment too. And if you don't catch up within 30 days, we're going to accelerate and demand payment in full.
And what I'm trying to figure out is, why does damages have to be foreclosure? I mean, the alleged breach requires them to do something that they wouldn't otherwise have to do that may put them in a bind financially. So why wouldn't that be damages as opposed to our traditional conception of damages, whether somebody has lost wages or income or whatever? I mean,
it can be.
That's not a hostile question, right?
No, an improper acceleration notice can cause damages. If you believe you are current and you get an acceleration notice saying, you need $17,000 or we're going to foreclose, which is exactly what the Jackson case said, you've been damaged.
Because I might have another use for that $17,000
Even
just collect interest on.
Precisely. And there have been cases where, there are a plethora of cases where a foreclosure has not occurred, but the allegation has been that the acceleration notice was improper. And I think that the Van Dam case is precisely on point in terms of what happens when you have a gap in between when the breach occurs and when the damages accrue. Statute of limitations are strictly enforced and narrowly construed. This was a malpractice case for divorce. In 1986, a property settlement agreement was incorporated into a final degree of divorce. Her ex-husband died 20 years later, in 2006, and she applied for federal benefits, federal death benefits, and was denied. And the agency said the property settlement agreement wasn't crafted specifically or in a way that lets you're entitled to these death benefits. So she sued her divorce attorney for malpractice, and was not successful because the statute of limitations had long passed. It was a breach of contract action on malpractice. The breach accrued when the defective language in the property settlement agreement was drafted by her attorney back in 1986. So she had until 1991 to pursue those claims, even though she didn't learn about them until 2006. And it was a 2010 case from this court. And it acknowledges that there can be harsh realities in situations where there is a long gap between when a breach accrues and when the damages are discovered. But it's the role of the General Assembly to address that. To find, in a case like this, that the statute of limitations doesn't accrue until an actual foreclosure would be upend centuries of not only foreclosure law, but breach of contract law in general.
And 5 years is still a pretty long time.
And in fact, the appellant in this case sued Wells Fargo in 2012. That case was removed to federal court and dismissed on other grounds, and we did not have a basis to bring res judicata. But these allegations were well known to the plaintiff. I believe the acceleration notice was June of 2010. The date of foreclosure was August 23rd, 2011. They first filed suit against Wells Fargo in 2012, and I apologize, I can't remember the basis of those claims, but I know it's not the same here because we looked at a res judicata issue, but the nature of the claims were known to the appellant well before the new filing of this suit in August of 2016.
Has there ever been an allegation in these litigation proceedings that if the debtor had actually gotten 30 days secured notice as opposed to 29 days, allegedly, that they could have done something about it.
No.
So we're spinning around the axle of something that is, one, hypothetical, and two, there's not even an allegation that the breach was followed up by any cause in fact for any damage of
That's
any
correct.
Kind.
That's correct. And there have been other cases. I know the appellant cites the Bayview case, which, you know, stands for the proposition that you have to comply with the requirements of deed of trust in notice to the borrower before you can accelerate, before the foreclosure is proper. And one of the things, we actually scoured, you know, it wasn't, we got a copy of the original amended complaint, which didn't make it up on appeal, the earlier pleadings. And the borrower in that case specifically alleges, had they been provided, and that wasn't a 30-day notice, that was, I think that was the difference between a certified letter and just a letter that was mailed. But had notice been proper, they were ready, willing, and able to cure the default. And so that is not an allegation in this case.
But here, of course, there's no one seeking a rescission of the sale of the property or an injunction precluding it or an injunction unraveling it. It's a claim for damages, which means you have to prove damages, which means you have to prove causation.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that the fact that none of those allegations are in there, and this borrower moved out of the property, there was an unlawful detainer, none of these issues were raised. He vacated the property years ago, there's never been an allegation that he was able to cure these defaults. So this is, you know, foreclosure is not a strict liability set of rules. It's substantial compliance and now, of course, if there's a material breach, that's a different story. But the Bayview case stands for you have to send a certified notice as opposed to just mail it by regular mail. And there are certain things that are considered material breaches over others. But this is not a strict compliance type of area of the law. And, you know, I just keep going back to Virginia Code 8.01230. A right of action shall be deemed to accrue from the date when the breach occurs. And this breach occurred when the acceleration note, allegedly 29-day as opposed to 30-day notice was sent. And at that moment, this borrower had a cause of action. They, if a foreclosure sale was set, they could have applied to the court for an injunction or seeking some sort of declaratory relief. And in fact, the Jackson case, which they rely on, permitted a cause of action to go forward on strictly an acceleration notice, even with no foreclosure. So I see that I have additional few minutes, but I really rest on my argument. So.
All right, thank you very much. Rebuttal?
I submit that counsel has misconstrued the Jackson case. The Jackson case actually spoke to both issues. What the Jackson case held was is that the borrower could not sue for the acceleration notice. It couldn't sue on the grounds that the lender had claimed to have accelerated. The borrower could only sue because the lender coerced out of the borrower $12,000+ that the borrower wasn't due, and said that. That allowed a claim to go forward on the contention that the borrower was actually up to date on the loan and the lender coerced them to pay money that they didn't owe. But that case had both points in it. One was coercing somebody. They said they have actual damages because they were out the money. But the court also held that there was no claim for an insufficient cure notice or incorrect cure notice because no foreclosure had occurred. They held both things, and this comes to an important issue, which is it is a very fundamental thing in Virginia law and in law throughout the country that people can threaten things that go beyond what they're entitled to do. And a landlord can say to a tenant, I will come and lock you out, and cannot be sued for that if they don't actually come and lock somebody up. And what the appellee is asking the court to hold here is that if you say that you are able to foreclose, and you haven't actually done it and don't do it, you can still be sued for that.
Is Jackson a case addressing accrual for purposes of statutes of limitations? Is that the issue in Jackson, accrual?
No, Jackson wasn't the statute of limitations. It was whether or not the borrower could go forward at all. This was a pre-foreclosure case. But the point in Jackson was the court held no cause of action had accrued. And I just want to say finally that if you can sue somebody for threatening something that they haven't had a right to do and haven't done, it's a real problem because you're going to erode these rights. And thank you for that.
Call the next case.
Can I be